Okay, I'll now pass it over to Jack Herman, who will open today's call.
Thanks so much, Shelly. I want to thank you all for joining us today. I'm Jack Herman. I'm the acting director of ASPR's National Healthcare Preparedness Programs. The purpose of today's session is to discuss the challenges and issues in fulfilling requests for healthcare workers during the current nationwide COVID-19 surge. During today's meeting, we will kick off with an overview of the COVID-19 Healthcare Resilience Working Group and the impact of healthcare worker staffing shortages as it looks today. Then we will have a representative from ASPR's Tracy, and she will share some of their great workforce shortage resources. Then we'll look forward to hearing from our colleagues at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs to provide a federal supply schedule update. And then finally, we'll open the line for questions and answers from the group. Next slide, please. Before we jump into the agenda items, I would first like to provide a quick overview of the HHS Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response for those less familiar with the agency. ASPR's mission is to save lives and protect Americans from 21st century health security threats. And ASPR was created in the wake of Hurricane Katrina by the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act to lead the public health and medical preparedness for response to and recovery from disasters and public health emergencies. Since then, ASPR has evolved into an organization that collaborates with hospitals, healthcare coalitions, biotech firms, community members, state, local, tribal, and territorial governments, and other partners across the country to improve readiness and response capabilities from the public health and healthcare perspective. It's also the lead for the Emergency Support Function 8, which is Public Health and Medical Services, and ASPR coordinates the mechanisms of assistance and response to an actual or potential public health and medical disaster. Next slide. The National Healthcare Preparedness Program, which is a branch within the ASPR organizational unit and is responsible for the Hospital Preparedness Program, a cooperative agreement, and other healthcare systems and workforce activities that fortify the nation's healthcare preparedness and response capacity. And the Healthcare Preparedness Program, or the National Healthcare Preparedness Program, really spans these four areas. We have a number of initiatives. Our primary recipients for our cooperative agreement are the 50 states, 8 U.S. territories and freely associated states, and 4 metropolitan areas, New York, L.A., D.C., and Chicago. These, by statute, are the jurisdictions that ASPR funds in an effort to strengthen and build healthcare preparedness across the country. So just wanted to you to see that information about ASPR for those who may not be aware. And so what I'd like to do now is move on to our first presentation on the Healthcare Resilience Working Group and an overview of the impact of healthcare worker staffing shortages. And turn to Joselito Ignacio, who's the deputy of the COVID-19 Healthcare Resilience Working Group. Joselito?
Yep, thank you so much, Jack. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Dr. Sim, our work group lead, and the members of our working group. So ASPR has been on the forefront of the COVID-19 response since its start, since this disease started overseas. One element of those efforts was to stand up a task force, now considered a working group, dedicated to healthcare resilience during and after the pandemic. The Healthcare Resilience Working Group is an interagency response mechanism that was established in January and on to now to respond to COVID. It is interagency in the sense that we have quite a diverse group of folks with representatives from ASPR, CDC, FEMA, HRSA, NIH, FDA, CMS, and DOD. Part of our job is, or one of our primary jobs is to not only work with our federal partners, but also to work with state and local and territorial and tribal governments, as well as our engagements on an almost daily basis with the private sector healthcare system to find ways to reduce or minimize morbidity and mortality and ensure the safety of our healthcare workforce. Next slide. So after starting in January with four work streams of healthcare delivery, behavioral health, at-risk individuals, and telemedicine, the work group expanded to its current operating structure, broken up into four vertical teams that covers the spectrum of delivery of care, two functional teams, data analytics and external engagement that support those four vertical teams. And then we have support teams focused on workforce behavioral health of the healthcare community, telemedicine, and supply preservation with a focus on personal protective equipment and finding ways to extend the duration of PPE during a time when resources were very limited and to a very much extent still is. We also have liaisons with the various agencies depicted on the slide, who not only maintain situational awareness of what we're doing in healthcare resilience, but also share relevant information from their respective organizations to inform our work group priorities. Next slide. So with regards to the staffing shortages, if you, the data, the graphic on the left indicates the new daily admissions of patients with either confirmed or suspected COVID-19 infection. There was a dip after a peak in late July with new admissions now increasing to over 20,000 per day in the past week. On the bottom slide, you can see a similar trend with the total number of COVID-19 patients in the hospital, where the total COVID-19 hospitalizations are approaching 90,000 into late November. On the right, the top chart displays the percent of hospitals reporting critical staffing shortage for the current week into our HHS Protect since the July peak. A caveat that we don't have the complete month's worth of data for November at the time. This is reported as of 24 November. But what you can see in the time series graph by day above and the day aggregated by month below is that the percent of hospitals reporting critical staffing shortage is similar between the July and November peaks, despite a tripling of increased daily cases. Now, why are staffing shortages not more widely reported in November? In part, this may be due to the more widespread geographic distribution of cases as of November. It may also represent regional differences in affected hospital systems. The July peak was centered in the Southeast, especially Florida, while the November peak is driven by outbreaks in regions 5, 7, and 8. Examples, Wisconsin, Illinois, and the Dakotas. A number of hospitals reporting any information on staffing shortages increased from July to October. This is due to increased compliance with reporting requirements as the HHS Protect database was deployed. This bar chart displays the 16% to 23% of hospitals with reported critical staffing shortage between July and August. A slight increase was observed during July, about 23%, the highest percentage, and in November, 22%, the highest percentage due to cases peaking. Next slide. What this shows more in a colorful illustration is that where the staffing shortages are occurring. So nationally, 20.3% of the facilities reporting projected staffing shortages. 30 states and territories report at least 20% of facilities have projected staffing. 18 of those report at least 20% of facilities have current and projected staffing shortages. The darker the color, the more, the higher the percentage of hospitals with staffing shortages being reported. So you can see that there. Next slide. So the Healthcare Resilience Working Group has developed this COVID-19 workforce virtual toolkit, early in the COVID-19 pandemic to provide some resources to healthcare decision makers on workforce specific issues. It's a comprehensive toolkit containing 13 unique resource collections on topics such as workforce surge planning, workforce resilience, workforce training resources, and solutions from the field. As members of your organizations face new and recurring challenges due to the protracted nature of the COVID-19 response, this toolkit can really help members access best practices, tools, and resources to train, extend, and protect the healthcare workforce. This toolkit is hosted on the Ask for Tracy site, which is HHS's Technical Resource Assistance Center. As of October 2020, the toolkit has accumulated 78,616 views, which is great. The toolkit is the most visited on Ask for Tracy. The figure to the right shows the Workforce Virtual Toolkit landing page on Ask for Tracy. Users can use the links under the resource collections to navigate to a variety of topic areas. And then following this, we will distribute the link to the Workforce Virtual Toolkit, as well as a quick resource guide on HRWG that HRWG has developed with the top links from the toolkit. And then I guess we'll save questions to the end, and I'd like to turn this now over to Ms. Shane Brandman.
Let's see, hey Shane, let's see if you're on mute, you may need to come off mute.
Sorry about that. Thanks, Captain Ignacio, and good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jane Bramman. I'm the director of ASPR Tracy, which is the Technical Resources Assistance Center and Information Exchange that is sponsored by ASPR. Next slide. For those that are new to ASPR Tracy, which I think the majority of you may be new to ASPR Tracy, we basically are broken down into three domains. And as Captain Ignacio indicated, we're a technical resources center, but we're also have become a premier healthcare information preparedness gateway. And again, we have three domains. It's technical resources, which are self-service collection of audience-tailored materials. And we specifically curate those materials through a wide array of subject matter experts to hone in on the most promising and best information possible versus the entire landscape of resources that are out there. So we really try to tailor it down for you to make sure that you have the best in show and the most valuable resources that are dispensed through Ask for Tracy. But if you can't find through Ask for Tracy what you're looking for, you can call us, you can email us, or reach out through an online form. And we have not a call center, we have very trained and very experienced professionals who work daily in healthcare system preparedness, response, and recovery. And we will tackle your technical assistance request and get you the best virtual resources out in a very quick amount of time. So again, if you can't find what you're looking for on our website, simply contact our assistance center and we'll quickly get you the resources you need. The third domain of Ask for Tracy, which requires just a small amount of information. You can come into the Technical Resources Center at any time and you don't have to provide any information. You can surf as much as you want. But for the third domain, the information exchange, it's a password protected discussion among vetted users in near real time. And we have several chats going on from a wide array of different constituents and have peer-to-peer exchanges and share templates and plans and other materials. So these are the basic elements of Ask for Tracy. Again, we're a healthcare information gateway, and we have the three domains. Next slide. For many of you out there, again, we are a all hazards technical assistance center. So in addition to COVID-19, we were developed 5 years ago, and we have a wide array of resources. But these three are specifically things that we think you might be interested in on volunteer management topic collection that talks about some of the best resources that we know on how to integrate volunteers into organizations. We also have a responder safety and health topic collection, as well as a training and workforce development topic collection. And these were developed prior to COVID. Next slide. This next slide, and again, I'm just trying to give you a quick glimpse of what Asper Tracy is, but these are all the resources that we currently have on Tracy that we think are specifically tailored to what your needs might be. Again, we have an entire novel Corona resource page, but we also have a workforce virtual toolkit that Captain Ignacio talked about. And for all the healthcare resilience task force, and then later called a working group, for most of their virtual resources, Asper Tracy is that landing page for them, and we create and tailor resources on Asper Tracy to best promote the good work that they have continually done since early on in COVID-19. But areas such as surge training resources and how to, again, do a wide array of different aspects. We have a couple different articles we just did on ambulatory care centers and some of the lessons learned and different aspects like that. You can come into Tracy, I don't want to overwhelm you, but we have a wide array of resources. But if you can't find what you're looking for, simply contact us, and our staff is standing by to meet your needs, and we want to make sure that we get you the best resources into your hands as quickly as possible. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you today, and I'm going to actively listen during the Q&A session because I want to understand what are your knowledge gaps, because one of the last things that Asper Tracy does when there isn't a resource that has been developed, similar to what the Healthcare Resilience Working Group staff does, we tackle very difficult issues and we develop resources so that we can fill the knowledge gaps that are out there. So if you have specific needs in the days ahead, let us know, and we'll be sure to closely evaluate it and see if we can contribute to closing that knowledge gap. It is now my distinct honor to turn the presentation over to Bob Satterfield, who helps oversee the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs supply schedules. Bob, over to you, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Again, Bob Satterfield, I'm the Chief of the Federal Supply Schedule Service Team at the VA, NAG. Please, you can join me today. The schedule I manage is for temporary healthcare staffing services, for providing temporary staffing for doctors and nurses. We don't do home care, but we do everything else. Recently, we had a webinar for a 6-month contractor, so I'm only going to focus on two elements of today's presentation, which are pricing flexibilities and the VHA staffing portal. Next slide, please. Under the schedule of 6-month, we have pricing that's negotiated based as a national not-to-exceed rate covering all geographic locations awarded under a contract. The expectation that the activity company also will negotiate a price downward that's appropriate for the location based upon the requirements or the location. Generally, pricing is adjusted based upon either under EPA clause, which use a CPIU, the Consumer Price Index, or market-based changes. With COVID-19, we realized that our pricing was not allowing our facility to hire the most qualified persons at a higher rate. So we modified all of our scheduled contracts to allow a market differential to be negotiated at the ordinary activity level. In addition to the set price, if the CEO determined that price differential was appropriate for the location, and importantly, whether or not fair and reasonable. The contractor should make sure during activity is aware of the enhanced flexibility. We did inform all our facility via VHA leadership, but we know that sometimes each hospital may not be aware of the flexibility. And this is a major departure from our normal contract practice where pricing is usually capped at the not-to-exceed rate. But again, we realized that the not-to-exceed rate was not going to allow our facility the flexibility need to attract and retain their temporary staff in long haul. And we know the competition between the state and local government is quite high at this point in time. One thing to be mindful of is that the travel and lodging is not included in our pricing. That price for travel lodging should be a separate price line item for the owner activities that include federal facilities as well as state facilities. And one thing regarding our schedule is open to all federal agencies, and during the pandemic is also open to state and local agencies, as long as the pandemic is still a declared emergency by the President of the United States of America. Next slide, please. I want to discuss the VHA portal for a moment. This is a combination of VHA and FSS collaboration over the last couple of years. And this is really pretty big for us. Many of vendors have asked about VA requirements. What is VA's interest? What are providers, what are our needs, what are our requirements? And you've been very interested in supporting VA fight against COVID-19, but you just need more information. Last September 2020, VHA leadership issued guidance to all VA facilities to post their upcoming requirements for temporary staffing to the VHA portal. This is a brand new portal just launched this year. And this portal will give unprecedented visibility to our needs. The portal is very easy to use. It is presented as a map of the United States, and you just click on location to see what VA requirements are. This again is a tremendous step forward in making sure that you are aware of what our future needs are so that you can plan for it. At this time, the VAs are going to train on how to use the portal. And again, their training also is rather user-friendly. So we'll have to update their information. Next slide, please. So with this portal, we hope industry will increase their partnership with VA and other agencies and find the FSS program more user-friendly. And some of the key takeaways are as follows. The portal is mandatory use by VA. Every facility must begin uploading their requirement to the portal. Contractors can see all labor categories organized by states, and we'll have information on the pricing, information on the positions that are being sought. And that way you're able to look at your capability and determine what you need to do in terms of being able to support the VA in their request for hiring temporary staffing. If you find that your contract, your federal specific contract does not have a labor category or does not have a location, you can now submit modification to us early in the process so that you're ready to support VA. So instead of submitting a request for modification to your contract at the last minute because you just learned of a VA requirement, you now have time to submit modification to us. And we can process the modification as quickly as possible. And I think what's really most important is that you're able to forecast what your needs are. So if you realize that you don't have a certain labor category, a certain provider, you can now try to acquire that provider and know where your people should best be placed, in what part of the country, what VA. So hopefully we're trying to make the unknowns of our requirements and our future less unknown. And another great point is to make that by seeing our requirements up front early, you're able to see where our needs are and provide feedback to the owner activity. Because you know, before it becomes an issue, the VA must do extensive research to identify who can provide the service, what are restrictions, what are requirements, who's available, what are needs set aside for small business, veteran business, they have their own businesses. And this will help us in identifying those areas. So we believe this portal will be very useful for you as well for VA. And in terms of VA, we also are using the portal to share information among our facilities. If VA Hines sees a requirement at VA and another location, they can partner with that location and consolidate their requirement to aggregate requirements and leverage our buying power slightly. Next slide, please. This next slide shows some of the data that will be displayed in the VHA internet portal. As you can see, you'll look at the number of FTE that's being requested, special item numbers, and most importantly, the point of contact at each facility. Many of you have asked me, who do you call when there is a need at a facility? and this portal will give you the information. Next slide, please. This is a map that is on our website, actually Vision website, be more precise. And it shows the United States, and it is an interactive map that where if you just click on any location, you will be able to see what facility requirements are at any given time. And the next slide, please. In this particular slide, this is the extract from that map where it shows one location, Roseburg, Oregon, and you see they're looking to recruit or acquire two lab techs and also one phlebotomist. And you'll see that the expected start date is April 1st, 2021. And in the right-hand side on the FTE shift hours, it shows you the number of hours that they're looking for. And in the spreadsheet, or in the column rather, you see the facility POC, who you can contact regarding this requirement. So again, this is only a snapshot. My last view of the website, they had about six or so locations. And again, this is still being ramped up by VHA, but they're predicting that all facilities will be posting their requirement. And as you see, this is April 1st, 2021. That gives you, the industry, 4 months or more to prepare for the upcoming requirement. Next slide, please. We have developed some questions that we thought you might have about the VHA portal. So I'm going to read the verbatim for the most part and the response that we have for you. So first question is, how does this portal information impact the contracting process and speed up the filling of vacancies? The portal speeds up processing by alerting local VMCs of contracting and of real-time vacancies and making available local provider market research and easy to search centralized location for customers and COs. Will the tool be developed so that we can submit our quote directly into the pool and save time? Not this time. Ideally, the portal will be able to function as a publicizing tool, but a feasibility that is still being discussed internally. So at this point in time, you'll still need to peruse GSA eBuy or beta.sam.gov for any upcoming procurement requests. If you are already on FSS, do we have to submit a quote? Or is that information already being pulled from our existing contract based on availability reporting? As you know, every week or two, actually about every 2 weeks now, I send a survey to all 6 2NI contractors asking for your availability of your providers. It gives a good gauge to what's available to the VFA ordering facilities. So the response to the question is that FSS counter prices are ceiling prices. So you still need to submit a quote once the RFQ has been publicized with your specific proposed price and key personnel. And again, the goal is that you offer a price that is representative and appropriate for that location based on their requirements and the geographic location. And typically, in normal time frame, a lower price than the national, not a fee price that we negotiate under the base contract. Is there a process for a vendor to submit suggestions on how to make it more efficient? There's no functionality to submit suggestions at this point in time. However, we do welcome suggestions. Please send your suggestions to fss.help@va.gov. And the next slide. So these are the points of contact for Mr. Shearer, my director, myself, and my team lead. And again, I just want to provide a very quick recap of information that we shared earlier with our vendor community. If there are any questions, feel free to give us a call or email. Happy to assist. And again, we appreciate your support of the VA and the federal government fight against COVID-19. Thank you very much. And now I turn it over to Jack.
Thanks so much, Bob. And thank you to all of our presenters today. We now would like to take questions and provide answers. While you're writing out your questions in the chat box or raising your virtual hand to ask a live question, I'd like to thank everyone who filled out the brief questionnaire in preparation for this call. The majority of those who responded indicated
that they're finding and hiring qualified healthcare professionals in a timely manner, and the majority, with the majority taking an average of 8 to 14 days. The most solicited healthcare professionals requested include registered nurses, nurse practitioners, respiratory therapists, certified nursing assistants, and physicians. Key challenges include competitive hiring with other firms, limited availability of certain healthcare worker clinical specialties, and healthcare workers' willingness to relocate. Staff turnover has been low, with approximately greater than 80% of healthcare workers hired staying on until the end of the contract period. We look forward to hearing more about these challenges and also welcome your questions or comments you have for the speakers. Let's also, I believe we're gonna put, if we haven't already, the link to the survey. If you've not filled out the survey, please feel free to do so. We are asking that we limit it to one survey per company represented on the call. If you're not quite sure if your colleague has filled out the survey, go ahead and fill it out anyway, and we'll adjust for that on the end once we start analyzing the data. But want to thank you all in advance for participating in that survey. So let's see if we have questions here.
We do have a couple questions in the chat that have come in. William Kent asks, how quickly can you process a modification to our FSS schedule to add a particular state that we don't currently have?
Thank you, sir. This is Bob Satterfield once again. Our typical time frame on the normal circumstances is 60 calendar days to process a modification to any of our contracts. Within COVID-19, we are expediting as quickly as we can any modification request. It depends upon what that you're adding, depends on the quality of the modification that you're submitting to us, and of course our workload. We are not going to take 60 days to do a add mod to your contract. I can't guarantee a certain number of days. At the outset, I would probably recommend about 30 days, and that depends upon, again, the quality of modification, the back and forth communication between our office and your organization, and what data you provide to support your request. We still require that you show that you have the capability of supporting that location by providing invoices and other proof that you have done so in the past. We have relaxed our requirement. We're not asking for two or three invoices to show that you are making placement, but at least one or two in that location. Or if you have a copy of your commercial agreement or another government contract that where you have actually made payments under, that can support your request. If you are submitting a modification request in response to a requirement from VA or any other agency, I would recommend you do send me an email, give me a call to discuss that request, and we can make sure that your mod is expedited as quickly as possible. Hope to answer your question a little bit.
Thank you very much, Bob. Let's also move on to Murray Shalom's question, because I think this would also be for Bob. Is there a national tracker for healthcare employees' waivers, i.e. allowing temporary nursing licenses out of state or and out of state license holders, et cetera? Are you aware, Bob, of anything?
No, I'm not aware of what we have seen, and I take that back. I'm not aware of a national tracker. I am aware of a website that we did visit a little while ago that showed the very states that were issuing waivers to those providers that were fully licensed and had an untreated license in different states. To work in different states. And I could probably share that information after the presentation, but I'm not aware of a actual centralized database. I'm looking for it right now as we're speaking. And under the VA contract, on the FSS contract, any provider that is licensed can work in any VA facility once they meet the conditioning requirements and pass the VA's standards. The issue comes in if where you're trying to work in a state facility, non-federal facility, whether or not they will accept your license. But most states have relaxed the requirement to allow for cross transfer between states. And again, I can try to find that document I had before and share with the group after the meeting.
Thank you very much, Bob. Let me jump up, if I can, to Shakira Freckleton's question, which is, will your organization be involved with the rollout of the vaccine? As many of you probably watch on TV, Operation Warp Speed and the Center for Disease Control are the primary leads, if you will, in the vaccine strategy and all activities related to the implementation of that strategy and the distribution of the vaccine. Where ASPR's role is ensuring that the strategy includes the interests of the healthcare sector. And so what we have been doing in collaboration with Operation Warp Speed and the CDC is reaching out to various stakeholders, acute healthcare systems, long-term care, various professional disciplines in an effort to educate and inform them on the current strategy and proposed process, and then ensuring that they have a voice to OWS and CDC on any potential impacts, challenges, barriers in the implementation and or in the execution of the strategy. It's important to understand that each state health department, in essence, is responsible for their jurisdiction's vaccine strategy and working together with all the various entities to ensure that there is a robust distribution and dispensing plan in order to meet the vaccine priorities, which are currently in discussion. So, as I said, ASPR per se is not the lead of the vaccine strategy, but we are a supporting entity in ensuring that the healthcare sector is represented in that strategy. Moving on to Susan Salka's question about insights regarding the potential of the TREAT Act to be passed, and what can you all do to be helpful in support of this important bill. Susan, I don't have a lot of information on the TREAT Act. I understand what it is intended to do. I don't know if our VA colleagues at all have any thoughts or suggestions on this particular act, Bob or Dan?
None from Bob, sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, Susan, I think, you know, we are monitoring this just like everyone else. And, you know, obviously groups like yourself from the outside, outside of the federal government, have a strong voice. And you know, obviously, who your potential elected officials are and those who are instrumental for whether or not this bill proceeds, and encourage you to continue voicing those interests. Certainly, feel free to email us and make us aware of any specific interests that you have, and certainly we can take those into consideration with others that come into us and help inform whatever role we may have in this. Shakira Freckleton also had a question about most of the VA opportunities are still SDV-OSV set aside. Do you anticipate opening those opportunities to large business? We partner with quite a number of SDV-OSV, however, we prefer to work directly with the VA. Bob?
Andy, thank you. The short answer is no. We're required by Kingdomware and regulation to look at each procurement and determine if there is adequate competition at the small disadvantaged veteran, small disabled veteran level first. And I would get the acronym wrong before we open the procurement to unrestricted. So by law, we cannot change the way we look at procurement. It's always going to be first veteran-owned, disabled veteran-owned businesses, small veteran-owned businesses, and then we look at other categories. If the oriented return, there are not sufficient small disabled veteran-owned businesses, et cetera, then they can document their contract file, make a determination that there is no adequate providers or source, and then they can expand to other economic categories or go unrestricted. So at this point in time, I don't see where they're going to change that. But again, it comes down to the right criteria and they have to decide what is best for their facility.
Jack, I think you may be.
Thank you for that. And thanks, Bob, for your previous response. And I think we have another one for you from Arpit Paul. Are we correct in understanding that all the staffing needs will be released via solicitations, one by or beta.sam.gov, or can we also reach out to individuals and agencies to support their staffing needs?
Well, the solicitation will still be issued via either GSA eBuy system, and that's for all vendors who are a federal supply character contractor. And facilities can also issue through beta.sam. Majority will be issued through eBuy if they're going to use the federal supply character program as a resource for their requirement. If they're going or market, if they determine that the federal supply character program is not the best source for their requirement for whatever reason, then they'll probably go to beta.sam. You can talk to the facility individually and see what their needs are, what their requirements are to get an early handle on what's going on. But they still have to follow federal regulations and publicizing procurements, looking at proper set aside to small design business owners, vendors. So there's no permission. You can still speak to them, but they will still follow the user procurement rule of going to either eBuy or bid.sam. And bless you. And hope that answers the question.
Yes. So thank you very, very much, Bob. We got a number of messages and questions in here, so I'm going to move on. Given the time. Susan Selka also asked, is there any discussion regarding the ability to increase visa availability for RNs to come to the U.S. on a temporary or permanent basis to assist during this difficult time? And Susan, this is a great question, which obviously extends out to other professional disciplines beyond just nursing. ASPR and the Healthcare Resilience Working Group certainly has been aware of this issue right from the beginning of the COVID-19 response, as we were anticipating staffing shortages. Early on, we had discussions with the White House and other components of HHS to look at this issue. As you probably see, it hasn't been resolved yet. We're also working with professional associations representing these disciplines on this issue as well. Let me just turn to Bob and see if there are any specific activities that his group is working on in regards to these visa issues.
Unfortunately, Jack, no, we're not. I'm not aware of any activity that our group is working on or within our office as a whole. And I...
I appreciate that. This is, a very challenging issue, Susan, and we have been raising to the senior leadership level the range of challenges within here as we look at the staffing shortages that we're currently faced with and project that we're going to be faced with over the coming weeks and months. And obviously the challenge of using U.S. trained healthcare professionals who currently reside outside of the United States, the challenge of utilizing healthcare professionals who are trained outside of the United States that may be living in the United States, and all the permutations therein. So
you know, we believe we have a good understanding of the issue, if you will, but happy to entertain any other information that you share want to share with us that we can continue to pass on to senior leadership that may be able to, you know, present an open window to further address this this challenge. So thank you for that. Moving on, Richard Thompson writes, under the current circumstances with COVID-19 spiking across the country, what is your contingency plan for traveling staff? And let me first see, Bob, do you have any input on this?
No, I don't.
Yeah, and I would have to say right at the moment, we don't have specific information to share on this, though recognizing obviously that traveling individuals in the context of an emerging pandemic is a challenge. I think the other is that, you know, there are likely staffing shortage needs right in the jurisdictions where these individuals live. So the need to travel folks across the country or to various parts of the country may be dependent on the individual's specialties, obviously where your contracts reside, and any travel restrictions that might be imposed. But at this point, I don't have any definitive information, Richard, to share with you, and we'll certainly take that back for consideration. Moving on to Ramon Villegas, do you have any current needs for PTs and OTs nationwide so we can help our employees who've been displaced due to COVID? Again, I'll leave that to Bob. I'm not sure if you have any.
I don't have any specific information regarding those type of labor providers. Typically, just to give a little brief thing, I work with our Veterans Health Administration office and identifying what VA needs are. And what I can do is take the question back to our VHA folks and let them see if they can address it for us. In our particular area, our primary responsibility is developing the contract for use by our customers in our agencies. But we have developed a very close rapport with our VHA folks in the last 2 years of our partnership, of expanding our partnership, that we are trying to make sure that we can assist with identifying where the need is. And that one of the great advantages of the portal that's been developed is to try to show where the need is nationwide. But I definitely want to take the question back to our VHA folks and see if I can get an answer for y'all.
Thank you, Bob. Mark Panofsky had asked, can you share the website that shares the flexible rates during these COVID times? And I'm not sure if anybody put that link in the chat box yet, but Bob, is that a website you can share?
Let me clarify a little bit. The flexible rates are not, there's no one rate for flexibility. Well, the way the schedule is designed, we award a contract on a national basis. The pricing covers every location that a vendor has awarded for a particular labor category. And it's a national, not to exceed rate for the entire country. And we identify the state that has the highest cost and that would have the highest, and we negotiate the price that's appropriate for the highest cost state, taking account wage termination and other factors. So it's one national, not to exceed price. We realize that each location has unique requirements, either based on geography or particular limitation on providers. So we expect the order activity to negotiate price at the appropriate for a location, and usually that price is a downward price, a lower price. With COVID-19, we modify all of our contracts to allow each order activity to negotiate a price differential that is unique or appropriate for their location, so that flexibility rate or price differential will vary by location based upon that order activity's particular need, so that there is no lift per se for each location. So if you are a vendor seeking to respond to a request for quotation under the federal budget program, make sure that the organization is aware they have the flexibility to add a price on top of not a fee rate if that labor category, if that location, if the requirement warrants it, and if that CEO thinks that that's an appropriate price. So it does require some communication with the facility. It requires the facility to recognize they have the authority to negotiate a price that is higher than not the fee rate by adding that differential. But it's not a set price across the country, because we realize that we cannot negotiate 240 some different prices across the country. That's not something that we're capable of doing. Hopefully that kind of clarifies the differential, the flexibility we incorporate into our contracts.
Thank you, Bob.
Jack, this is Dan. And Bob, you're doing a great job answering the questions of everybody. This market differential is really an acquisition flexibility in support of the pandemic. So really what we were seeing is New York City staffs were overwhelmed. And then in order to get somebody willing to come into a hot spot of COVID, prices started going up for certain labor categories. And so really what this is if COVID is causing market conditions that require higher labor rates to get people into that situation, sometimes it's because of competitive forces between hospital systems and the government system versus private. And sometimes it's just because no one wants to do that job, okay? So I just want to reinforce in Bob's explanation that this is pandemic support related higher prices. It's not a recipe to, or a way to all of a sudden start trying to get higher prices for the services that you normally provide. It's really geared towards COVID pandemic support impacted staffing shortages. And I appreciate the little extra time to respond on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. I think that's important context to provide here, that you know, the federal government has been, since the declaration occurred in March, been looking at ways to be more flexible in the context of the challenges that we are experiencing today and anticipated that we would be experiencing throughout the pandemic. And so this is an example of some of those flexibilities that, you know, will have time limitations on them, but appreciate that additional info, Dan. We have about 4 minutes left and we have a number of questions still in the chat box. Let me just verify with Shelley, we're able to capture these and potentially can give these to our subject matter experts and provide a response when we post the slides and the audio recording. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, great. Just a couple things. Shane, you may be able to take this opportunity to submit leading practices to be included in toolkits from our lessons learned in mobilizing, credentialing, onboarding travel professionals, and supporting caregivers virtually with mental, emotional, and physical well-being. So the whole capturing of lessons learned.
Thanks, Jack. That's one of our fortes, and especially something that's near and dear to Jack Herman's heart is we are very concerned about forced health protection and the stress that's being placed and burden on healthcare professionals. And we have an exchange newsletter that's coming out next week. Again, if you sign up to Ask for Tracy, you'll be included on that distribution. But to Jack's point, we use a wide array of almost 1,000 different subject matter experts in a wide array of different domains to identify and curate and share the most promising practices and best lessons learned and try to cull that out. And we have several examples of that. And again, maybe the best way is for you to come into Ask for Tracy and we can give you a very tailored response in a very short period of time. Thanks, Jack, over.
Thank you, Shane. And let me say, the secretary has asked us to specifically reach out to our partners to get a
kind of an anecdotal sense of where our partners feel the government can be assisting in reducing healthcare worker burnout and fatigue. We know the top of the list is usually things like providing more PPE, providing additional testing, address staffing shortages, more funding. But you know, beyond that, because those are considerations we're looking at already, are there other ways that the government can be instrumental in helping relieve the burden and fatigue of healthcare workers across the country? And so if you have specific ideas that you're gleaning from your programs or from your the clients that you're working with, please feel free to pass those on. We are 1 minute out from the top of the hour. Yes. I want to thank everyone for being on today's call and appreciate your time and input. Remember, if you've not filled out the survey, please do so. Shelley, maybe we can go to the last slide. And if we can, if you have any questions, please feel free to email us at hpp@hhs.gov, or feel free to email me directly. Happy to take those questions or issues. So thank you again, and want to wish everyone a safe and pleasant evening. Take care, everyone. Thank you.